good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, April the 27th, 2017. Last Thursday in April this year. It is all flying right by. 12:16 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Scott Spears along with you on the Now program, and we have got a very interesting program for you today. I want to tell you what's coming on next hour before I get to this hour. This hour is going to be fascinating. Next hour, last week, we were supposed to have the original host of the TV game show Let's Make a Deal, Monty Hall, on this program. I have been assured today that Monty was busy last week. Something came up during the time when he was supposed to do the interview, and he has rescheduled for today. So if you want to hear the Monty Hall interview, that'll be at 1:15 this afternoon. So stay tuned for that. But this hour, we are going to have an interview with a man who certainly has a place in time. His name is Carlos Bringer. Carlos is a Cuban exile in the United States who campaigned against Fidel Castro, born in 1934. Now, Carlos testified before the Warren Commission, and as all of you know out there in listener land, the Warren Commission was the group formed by President Lyndon Johnson to find out what happened, what went on during the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Now, why was Carlos Bringer part of that commission, interviewed by that commission? Well, the reason is Lee Harvey Oswald did a radio debate. I believe it's the only radio he did, or certainly one of the few appearances he did, on August 21st, 1963, arguing Cuban policies. The person he debated in that August 21st, 1963 broadcast was Carlos Bringer. And Carlos is the last person surviving from that group. Lee Harvey Oswald's gone, the host of the program is gone, and there was another panelist who has also passed away. So Carlos is the only one still living who was there when that historic debate took place. And as you all know, a little over 3 months later, on November 23rd, 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald killed President John F. Kennedy. It's going to be an interesting hour. We're going to talk about Cuba, hear a little bit of that radio debate from 1963 between Carlos and Lee Harvey Oswald. But we are so glad to welcome to these microphones today Carlos Bringer. Carlos, how are you?
Very well, Scott. I am very glad to be speaking to the people of Ohio today through your good program.
Well, thank you so much. Carlos, I want to get right into this and start back way in the beginning. You were born in Cuba in 1934. What was Cuba like in the early days, in the 30s and 40s?
Well, let me tell you this. I was born June 22nd, 1934, and my father was a judge in the interior of Cuba. And finally, in 1939, we moved to Havana. And I grew up in Havana, in a section of Cuba that is El Vedado section. And I attended the Belén School, that was a Jesuit school in Havana, in Marianao, close to Havana. And it was a great times over there at that time.
Now, who was the leader of Cuba in 1934? Was it Batista?
That happened in 1934 when I was born. Batista was in charge of the situation in Cuba after Gerardo Machado has been deposed as president of Cuba. But from 1936 to 1940, my great uncle Federico Laredo was president of Cuba. And in 1940, there was an election, and Batista won the election and was president of Cuba from 1940 to 1944. During the period of my great uncle was when the Cuban Constitution of 1940 was written. And it was at that time considered the most advanced constitution in Latin America.
In the 1940s, when your uncle was president of Cuba, how would you compare it to the Constitution and the way we do things in America today?
Well, the Constitution that was written at the time of my great uncle being president was a constitution that put Cuba ahead of all the other countries in Latin America. There were a lot of different democratic ideas that were incorporated to that constitution, and Cuba was living in a moment where there was freedom, and when the elections came in 1940, battling for the election, and there was other candidates, and Batista won the election.
Now, in your growing up days, you went to the University of Havana and became a lawyer. Is that something you wanted to do? How did that all happen?
Well, when I was young, I had two ideas in my mind. One was to become a CPA. I like numbers. But my father was a judge, and he wanted me to be a lawyer. At that time, I took, in the morning, I was attending the University of Havana to become a lawyer. And at night time, I was attending the University of Havana to become a CPA. When I start working in the criminal courts, I have to decide which career I wanted to follow. And then at that time, I decided to follow a law school, and I was in the University of Havana until the University of Havana was closed for political reasons, and then I graduated from the University of Oriente, Norte of Oriente, as a doctor in law.
Now, you're living in Cuba at this time. You're a lawyer. Your great uncle has been president. Batista has been president. What starts to happen? When does the name Fidel Castro come on the scene, and how is he seen?
Let me tell you this. The first time that I heard the name of Fidel Castro was in late February of 1948, when he assassinated a cousin of mine by the name of Manolo Castro. They were not related, but Manolo Castro was the director of sports in Cuba at that time, and he had been the president of the Federation of Students of the University of Havana, and Castro had always had been confronting Fidel Castro because the students at the university liked my cousin Manolo Castro and disliked Fidel Castro. Fidel Castro was never able to win an election in the University of Havana.
When did he start to rise to power? When did you realize that this man is starting to get some real power here in Cuba?
Well, he never had a real power in Cuba until January 1st, 1959. But the problem was with let's put it in this way, the stupidity of the Cuban people that were attracted to his personality. Castro was a great orator, and the Cuban people was following him stupidly because they didn't realize that his brother Raul was a communist who has been in the communist country and who was working with the communists. But Fidel Castro was a gangster, and in November 1st, 1958, another cousin of mine died because of Fidel Castro. He was a pilot of the Cuban Airlines, and he was flying from Miami to Varadero Beach in Cuba, and Castro sent some of his people to Miami with weapons. They boarded the airplane, and when the airplane was in the air, they told my cousin, Roski Medrano was his name, told him that he had to fly to the Sierra Maestra. This is November 1st, 1958. Then my cousin told them that that was impossible, that they didn't have enough gasoline to reach the Sierra Maestra. Then they killed him. They stabbed him to death, and they got the co-pilot, to fly the plane to the Sierra Maestra. As my cousin has predicted, the plane crashed in the Bay of Nipe. Many of the passengers died, some others survived. Some of the hijackers died, and some of the hijackers survived. One of them was living until a few years ago in Coral Gables, Florida, and the government of the United States that had the obligation of treat that as a case of murder, okay, hijacking, that started in Miami, Florida, never did anything to put those people in jail or to attack Castro for that.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I believe that at least I and many of the Cubans that I met were very naive, and we were thinking that the United States was like Superman, and that everybody in the United States was nice people and were well-intended. We didn't realize that the communists had infiltrated the government of the United States, and that a lot of communists were in high spheres in the government of the United States. I believe that that was the main reason why Cuba had been communist for 50-some years.
Now, would there be any names that we would recognize high up in the government of the United States that you believe were communist?
Well, I believe, for example, that Dean Rusk was a communist. I believe that Dean Rusk was a communist. First, he started in Vietnam. And even at one time, when the Chiang Kai-shek in China was forced to go to Taiwan, he wrote a memo to an officer of the army of Chiang Kai-shek, in which he was exhorting this officer to get rid of Chiang Kai-shek, and he was offering all the support of the United States to the coup against Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan. After that, this man, for example, at the time of the Bay of Pigs, he went to see President Kennedy. He was the Secretary of State, and he went to see President Kennedy because he didn't like the idea of the Bay of Pigs landing to be in Trinidad. That was the perfect place to land, and he convinced Kennedy to move the landing site to Bay of Pigs that make it a disaster. Okay, then you have this man in his position, and when Kennedy was killed, he went to see Lyndon Johnson to move Lyndon Johnson to create a commission, because he didn't like the authorities in Dallas to do the investigation of the assassination. Of he didn't like the Congress to do the investigation of the assassination. He wanted a commission that could be controlled, that the assassination will not show the hands of Fidel Castro behind it.
So you believe that the hands of Fidel Castro were with the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
Well, you have to realize this. At that time in the Western Hemisphere, there were two leaders. One was John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the other was Fidel Castro. I remember that I was visiting many of the merchant ships that were arriving to New Orleans, and I found in the cabin of the sailors pictures of Kennedy in the war. Castro was trying to gain the sympathy of the people of South America, and Kennedy was confronting him in that stance. And I believe that that was one of the main problems in between Castro and Kennedy, that were two leaders living at the same time, and one had to get rid of the others, and Fidel Castro succeeded.
I'm going to come back to this in a second, but when Castro's coming to power in the late 1950s in Cuba, at what point did you decide he is going to come to power and I need to get out of here?
Well, let me tell you this. I was, when Castro took over, I was in vacation in Argentina. I am married for 61 years to a beautiful Argentinian lady. And we were on vacation over there with two of our kids. And before leaving Cuba, I had get in touch with a friend of mine that was working in the Argentinian embassy, because my father had been for 2 months president of the tribunal that was judging the terrorists that was placing bombs and killing policemen in Cuba. And at one time, Fidel Castro sent him an emissary from the Sierra Maestra with a list of people that Castro wanted to get out of jail. When my father realized that those people were accused of killing policemen and placing bombs in Havana, he told the emissary of Castro that he cannot put them free. Next day, the Secretary of Justice of the Batista government visited my father at the tribunal court, and he had a list of people that the government of Batista wanted to let free. My father looked at the names, and he found out that was the same list that Fidel Castro had sent to him from the Sierra Maestra. Then my father told the Secretary of Justice that it was impossible to let those people free because they were accused of killing policemen and placing bombs in Havana. Then the Secretary of Justice left, and next day my father was deposed from his post, and he had to return to his judgeship. And that, to me, bring clear what the terrible situation of the morale in Cuba was when the Secretary of Justice of the Batista government was asking to release the same people that Fidel Castro was asking to release.
So when did you leave Cuba?
I left Cuba for the last time in May 4, 1960. At that time, when I was a Secretary of Justice in the Justice Department in Cuba, and I didn't ask for permission in my courtroom to leave Cuba because I knew that I was not be granted that permission. But I had to get a permit from the government to leave Cuba, and I got that permit. And that day at 7 o'clock in the morning, we were in the airport to leave Cuba, my wife and the three kids that we had at that moment, and I. And I was, the thing that I believe that saved me, because I didn't sit in the courtroom that I was leaving. I didn't resign my job. I left a letter with a brother-in-law of mine to bring to the courtroom after I had been in Guatemala. And then they saw a thing that I have in my jacket, in my coat, that said that I was secretary of the criminal court, and I believe that they assumed that I was with the government. In the courtroom, nobody knew that I was leaving. I didn't ask for a license or permit or nothing like that. And after I was in Guatemala, a brother-in-law of mine that also were in the criminal courts presented my letter of resignation to the judge.
You came?
I stayed in Guatemala for about a month. My father thought that I was crazy going to Argentina because we would be back in Cuba in 6 months. But I went to Argentina, and I stayed in Argentina almost a year.
When did you come to the United States?
I came to the United States in it was January 31st or February 1st of 1961 when I came here from Argentina. When I left Argentina, I came to Guatemala, and from Guatemala, I went to Miami. But let me tell you this, Scott. While I was in Argentina, after I left Cuba, No, before I left Cuba, when I was on vacation in Argentina in 1959, was when my mother-in-law wake me up and said that Batista had left Cuba and that the revolution has won. I went to the Cuban embassy. They had a big celebration over there, and I talked to the person that was in charge of the celebration, and I identified myself, and I told him that I was not, that before I was not for Castro, that at that moment I was not for Castro, and that I will never be for Castro, but that they have won, and that I wish that they would do the best for Cuba. A few days after that, the first exiles arrived, and one of them was the leader of the labor groups in Cuba, the labor associations in Cuba, by the name of Eusebio Mujal. Mujal had been a communist before, but he had broken up with the communists. And I wanted to talk to them to find out how my father was doing in the embassy. He was teaching me almost every day about communism. He was telling me how Castro was a communist. He was mentioning names of people that were communists with Castro. And I was impressed. To me, that was the first lessons that I received about communism in my life. Then I noticed that he was very nervous, and Mujal told me that the communists were going to kill him in Buenos Aires. His plan was to come to the United States. He had good relationship with the unions here in the United States, and he wanted to go in front of the Congress and denounce Fidel Castro as a communist. One day he gave me money, he gave me his passport, and I went to the airline company and got the ticket for him to leave Buenos Aires. After I brought the ticket to him, he told me that he could not go to the airport in a taxi because the taxi driver was going to kill him. I thought that he was paranoid, that he was thinking too much about this, the problem, okay? And I was very young and very naive. Then finally, I decided to bring him to the airport. And the day that he left to the airport, that I remember that was a Sunday, we picked him up at the Hotel Crillon where he was staying. And we got him out of the hotel with a disguise. My father-in-law had the car. He was the owner of the car, and me. And we took him to my father-in-law's house, and we had lunch with him over there. And then from there, we brought him to the airport. And eventually, he took the airplane to come to the United States. What I did, well, 2 days after that, the Cuban consul that had been at my wedding, in Buenos Aires in 1956, was contacting me over the phone because he wanted to know where Mujal was, because he had been trying to contact Mujal for 2 days and he had not been able to contact Mujal. Then this Cuban consul had not been far at that time from the from his post by the Castro government. Then I told him that the last 2 days I have not seen Mujal neither, but I didn't tell him that Mujal had left. Then he told me, if I see Mujal, please tell him to be very careful, because there were two men that arrived from Uruguay that have instruction from Castro to kill Mujal in Buenos Aires. At that time, I realized that Mujal was not so crazy, that Mujal knew how the communists operate, and that they wanted him not to come to the United States. Later on, after I was in Cuba, I returned to Cuba in January 26, 1959. After I was in Cuba, I received a letter from my father-in-law telling me that they have received a letter from Mujal, who was in Europe, because when he arrived to Miami, the communists in the State Department of the United States cancel his visa. And I have seen his passport, and he has a good visa to come to the United States. The communists in the State Department canceled his visa because they didn't want Mujal to expose the Castro's communism. And then he had to go to Europe, and he had to stay in Europe for about a year. And then when he was allowed to come to the United States, everybody knew that Fidel Castro was a communist.
Mm. It's an amazing story. Carlos, when did you encounter Lee Harvey Oswald for the first time? How did that happen?
Well, for the first time, okay, I was working as a co-manager of a store on the Cairo Street in New Orleans. The name of the store was Casa Roca. I was not the owner, and I was working with my brother-in-law as co-managers, both of us. We decided to put the name of the store. We suggested to the owner to put the name of the store Roca because my brother-in-law, his name was Rolando, and my name is Carlos, Ro from Rolando and Ca from Carlos, and Roca in Spanish means rock, and I believe that we believe that was a good name for the merchant seamen that we were trying to attract to that store. This was now in August 5th, 1963. I was in the store and talking with two young Americans, kids, that were asking questions about Cuba. And at that moment, another person came into the store and started looking around and finally approached us and started listening to what I was saying. And then he offered to train Cubans to fight against Castro because he had been in the Marine Corps and he had experience in guerrilla warfare and he can train us. I told him that I didn't have nothing to do with military activities, that I was just the delegate of the Cuban Student Directorate, and I was in charge of informing the Cubans about what was going on in Cuba and about propaganda and trying to get the newspapers follow what was going on in Cuba. Finally, he identified himself as Lee Harvey Oswald. He put his hand in his pocket and he tried to offer money to help our cause against Fidel Castro. And I told him that I could not receive any money from him, that he should contact our office in Miami and there he can send the money to them. Then I left from the store to go to the merchant seamen to the merchant ships that I was trying to sell merchandise to them. And they left. Next day, Oswald returned to the store and gave my brother-in-law, Rolando Peláez, his guidebook for Marines as a present for me. I still have that guidebook for Marines, and that helped me later on in my trial with Oswald. But then in August 9, a friend of mine, Celso Hernandez, came into the store very excited because when he went down from the bus in Canal Street, he found an American with two signs, one that said Hands of Cuba and another that said Viva Fidel. My friend Celso didn't speak any English, but he clearly understood the sign Viva Fidel. And then he started cursing Oswald in Spanish. But he came to me because I knew some English, and then he came to me to try to bring me over there to confront the American that was over there. Then I took another friend of mine that was working in the corner, Miguel Cruz, and the three of us went to Canal Street, and we were searching for this American for maybe half an hour in different sections of Canal Street, but we could not find him. Then I returned to the store. Celso and Miguel Cruz stayed over there. And finally, Miguel Cruz came running to the store and said that they have found this American on Canal Street again and that Celso was watching him. I took a big sign that I have of the Statue of Liberty being stabbed in the back by the communists, and we went to Canal Street and I started searching for Oswald, and finally I saw Celso, and Oswald was in the 600 block of Canal Street. When I realized that it was Oswald, I got mad, okay? I got very seriously disappointed. And then Oswald stretched his hand to try to shake hands with me, and I refused to shake hands with him, and I started insulting him and calling him traitor, communist, how dare he try to infiltrate our organization. And then it was a Friday afternoon, and a lot of people started gathering around us. At that time, I thought that the best thing for me was trying to move those people against Oswald, because I was a Cuban, the other two with me were Cubans, and Oswald was American. I said the best thing is to move the people that are here against him. And I start telling in English how Oswald had to infiltrate my organization, that he was a communist, and what they have, what we have been suffering in Cuba, and that I didn't want them to start suffering that in the United States. I had a good reaction from the public over there, and some of them start shouting at him, kill him, communist, go to Russia, and different things like that. At one time, I was very angry, and I took my glasses off, and I approached Oswald because I was ready to punch him. But then he took his arms and put it as an X in front of him, down, and he asked me, okay, Carlos, if you want to punch me, punch me, and he put his face. At that time, his cold blood woke me up, and I said, no, I am a Cuban, this is an American, he's doing a demonstration on Canal Street. If I punch him, I will be doing something wrong. And I stopped, and I didn't punch him. In the meantime, a policeman came and told us that we have to move. I said to him that we were not going to move because in Cuba they would not allow us to do that demonstration against Fidel Castro, and that we were not going to be anywhere. Then the policeman left, called the First District of Police, and after a few minutes, two police cars arrived over there and took off to the First District of Police and to jail. We had to put a bomb of $25 to get out of jail. And at one moment, we were all in the same room, the three Cubans and Oswald. And then the police start asking him questions about the membership, the members of his organization, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. And then Oswald said that he didn't want to set anything in front of me. Then the police moved him to another room. We were fingerprinted, photographed, and then I make a call to my brother-in-law to send bring the $25 for us to get free. Then he brought $50, and Celso and me were freed, and Miguel Cruz's father was the one who paid the bond for him. Then we were set for trial on August 12th, and that was a Monday. In the meantime, there was a big reunion of gathering of Cubans in a house to show our support for what I was doing. Then in the August 12th, in the morning, I went to the bank to place a deposit for the Casa Roca. And over there, I saw a newsman that had written several articles about me in the newspaper. His name was Bill Stocky, and that was at the National American Bank. He was in line to go to the teller, and then I approached him and I told him what has happened on August 9. And then I told him that it would be a good thing for him to cover the trial. he said that he was going to send someone over there to the trial. At the time that we arrived at the trial, the trial in New Orleans was, the courtroom in New Orleans was divided in those years in two sides. And one side see the white people and the other side see the black people. I sit with the other Cubans that were over there. And when Oswald arrived, he went directly, immediately to the black section and he sat down among the black people. I thought at that moment that he was smart, because he was trying to gain the support of the black people for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and for Fidel Castro. At the time that we were called, I had brought with me the guidebook for Marines. I showed it to the judge, and I told the judge the other two Cubans didn't speak almost any English, will assume their defense too and my defense. Then I narrated to the judge what had happened, said that we were not guilty, and then the judge interviewed Oswald, and after I have shown him the book of the guidebook for Marines with Oswald's name in the front page and have explained to him how he had tried to infiltrate our organization, the judge dismissed the charges against the three Cubans and fined Oswald in $10. That is the only time in history in the United States where Oswald was fined in a courtroom. And after that, he was interviewed on TV, and I was angry when I saw the newsman interviewing him in TV, because I didn't want that propaganda for him. But that newsman that was interviewing him in TV later on became a good friend of mine, because he was an honest man doing his job, okay? And then next day, August 13, Bill Stokey contacted me asking for Oswald's address. I asked him why he wanted to get Oswald's address. Then he told me that he wanted to interview Lee Harvey Oswald in his radio program. He had a radio program over there at WDSU Radio. And then I said to him, I tried to convince him not to bring Oswald into the station. I offered him to have a debate with Oswald. I said, it's the best thing that the people hear the two sides at the same moment. If you present him in one day and present me in another day, it's not the same people that are listening those 2 days. It's better to have a debate. Well, that was August 13. In August 16, Oswald have a demonstration in front of the International Trade Mart located Common and Camp Street. Then a person that had been a companion of mine in a school in Cuba, his name was Carlos Quiroga. His name is Carlos Quiroga. He was living in New Orleans at that time. He approached the store with a leaflet that Oswald have been passing in front of the International Trade Mart. I went to the International Trade Mart, but Oswald was gone. Quiroga returned then to my store later on, and I suggested that the best thing, Quiroga had one of the pamphlets that Oswald was distributing, where his address was there on Magazine Street. And then I suggested to Quiroga, why Quiroga don't go that night to Oswald's house and pose as a pro-Castro guy and see what the Fair Play for Cuba plans were for New Orleans. We did that, and that night Quiroga went to Oswald's house, and thanks to that, we discovered that Oswald spoke Russian, because Quiroga said that at one moment the daughter came into the room, the little baby, and walking, and Quiroga grabbed her like a sack of potatoes and started talking to her in Russian. And then Quiroga asked Oswald if that was Russian, and Oswald said that yes, that he was taking Russian at Tulane University. that was another of his lies. He was never taking Russian at Tulane University. That was in August 16. In August 21st, I arrived at WDUS DSU radio station about 30 minutes before the debate. And I was very naive, very young, and I brought with me to a radio debate the guidebook for Marine that Oswald had given to me. And then when I went there, Oswald was already there sitting with Stocky. A few minutes after that, Stocky went out to check in what room the debate was going to be held. Then I started talking with Oswald, and I told Oswald that I didn't have nothing personally against him because I considered that he was mistaken, that he was an American, that he was married with family, and that he should be fighting communism, not favoring communism, because communism was going to destroy the United States. He told me, Carlos, you are wrong. I am in the right side, and you are in the wrong side. After that, arrived Ed Butler, that was the director, the secretary general of the Information Council of the Americas, INCA, an organization that was sending through tapes to Latin America to be put on radio, showing interviews with different Cubans that have escaped from Cuba. We had the debate on the WDSU, and Butler had not told me before that he had a very good information about Oswald. And I was surprised during the debate that I learned that Oswald had been in Russia, that he had tried to resign the American citizenship. And to me, that was a complete surprise. For that reason, I limited myself in the debate because I believe that Butler and Stocky had better weapons against Oswald than me. I limit myself to two parts in the debate, to speak one in the first moment about the situation, economical situation in Cuba, and another one almost at the end of the debate when I confronted Oswald with a wording of Castro when Castro almost accused Kennedy of attacking Cuba and forewarning about what could happen to Kennedy. At that time, his answer was that the United States had been committing terrible acts in Cuba, and Cuba had the right to respond those acts that the United States was doing against Cuba. That was my participation in the debate. And after the debate, I saw that Butler has a press release. I have not had a press release. Then I went with Quiroga to his office, and I prepared a press release that I brought it to the press that night, asking the people of New Orleans to write to their congressman and ask for a congressional investigation of Lee Harvey Oswald, a confessed Marxist, and an agent of Fidel Castro. None of the television station or the newspaper or the radio station pay attention to my press release. On November 22nd, all of them were running after me to try to interview me. That was the last time that I saw Lee Harvey Oswald in person.
When the events of course, the assassination of John F. Kennedy happened, did it surprise you that it was Lee Harvey Oswald?
Well, let me tell you this. I was in my store, in the store that I was co-managing, and I received a call from a relative of mine that was working in a company that was related to the war, to the stock market, and they have received a teletype that Kennedy had been shot in Dallas. He told me that, and at that time I was surprised, and he called me about 5 minutes later and said that apparently the wounds of Kennedy were very serious and that he had died. I went to my house, have a late lunch in the house, and when I was listening to the radio while I have the lunch, I was living in one of the poorest sections of New Orleans in the St. Thomas Project housing. And when I heard on the radio that a person has been apprehended by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald, when I heard that, I jumped from the seat and I went to the phone, and the first people that I called was the FBI, telling them who I am and what happened with Oswald. Then I called the newspaper, and the newspaper invited me to go over there to the newspaper. And I arrived at the newspaper. I didn't like the editor of the newspaper because he was in my list of possible communists, but I went over there anyway. And when I arrived over there, Butler asked me to don't say anything because Stokey was trying to sell the story to the Times-Picayune. At that time, that sounded to me like revolting. The president of the United States has been killed. And
hey, Carlos, can I come? We're coming up on a hard break here. I be able to call you back in about 40 minutes? We have to do this interview with Monty Hall. Can I call you back in 40 minutes and we'll continue this?
Yes, no problem, okay. Scott. I will be here, okay?
I will talk to you in 40 minutes. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
I tell you, folks, what a fascinating story. We are going to break for 10 minutes, come back with Monty Hall, and then go back to Carlos Bringhair. Fascinating stuff. Stay tuned. Phyllis, how many conventions have you been to?
Well, I came to my first one in 1952, so you can count them up.
PH Radio, your propolis.